السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Brothers and sisters, welcome to today's chapter of the Big Picture Show here live on Radio Islam International. And a special welcome to all our listeners listening at Radio Al Ansar via live feed, and those that are on live stream as well. Well, dear listeners, please excuse me as my voice is sounding a bit weird. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to start off the show by playing three important clips. And then the short clips of about, roughly about, say, 20 minutes in total. But I want you to listen to them, because I will talk about them after the clips are over, in light of what is currently happening, whether it's in the Middle East, whether it's the campus protests in America, etc. And the clips will be as follows. The first one by C.J. Wellman on his Wellman show called "Can Arab Nations Save Palestine?" The second one is by David Hirst, the editor of Middle East Eye, that says that this could be the moment when Israel loses the West. And he's drawing comparison from the what is currently happening with the campus protest to what happened during the time of the Vietnam War. And the third one, which is very short, just over, say, about 2.5 minutes, the infamous Piers Morgan, the one who puts on his show, Piers Morgan Uncensored, always claiming to having the other side on air and giving them a view, but obviously he's always with his pro-Israel stance. His particular fancy one is about, do you condemn Hamas? Do you blame Hamas? So Piers Morgan always has got a fat lot to say, and he claims to be objective, but he's far from being objective. And here you got John Mersheimer, who is a leading American political scientist, who I will talk about after, when I come back on, after the clips, setting the record straight with Piers Morgan over his biased view on the Iran drone strikes at Israel. So please listen attentively to the three clips. They'll follow by an ad break, and then I'll come back on air till the end of the show, inshallah.
I'm C.J. Werleman, and in this episode, we explain why Arab regimes must end their misguided calls for a two-state solution and strike Israel hard. But first, please don't forget to like and subscribe to our show. Now let's get into it. After more than 180 days of bloodshed, the international community has done absolutely zero to stop Israel's genocidal siege of Gaza, which has now killed at least 35,000 Palestinian civilians, a majority of whom are women and children. But for Israel, this mass killing is not the beginning of the end. Rather, it's not even the end of the beginning. The Zionist regime has much worse in mind. It has now adopted a policy of starvation as a weapon of war to finish off those who remain clinging to life. Essentially, the Zionist state has offered Palestinians three deadly choices. Either we kill you with our bombs and bullets, or we starve and freeze you to death. Or you can flee our violence and deprivation by escaping Gaza for the Mediterranean Sea. Either way, we want you dead or gone. Israeli leaders have stated unambiguously the means and methods behind their intent to force 2 million Palestinians at gunpoint into rickety boats, from which they will be scattered throughout the Middle East. And it's carrying out this plan by closing off all of Gaza's borders and completely destroying the territory's critical infrastructure, therefore making Gaza totally unfit for human inhabitation. Palestinian survivors will be forced into boats and promised safety and shelter elsewhere, most likely Egypt, as European governments secretly hatch deals to offer the Sisi regime billions of dollars to house a further 2 million Palestinian refugees. And when this happens, any notion of a future Palestinian state will officially be dead and buried, because there's no Palestine without Gaza or its people. And when Israel sees that the Arab world will have done absolutely nothing meaningful to stop the annihilation of Gaza, then it will move ahead with plans to forcibly expel another 2 million Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. This will be the end of Palestine. they will soon join the other 6 million Palestinian refugees who have already been denied their lawfully protected right to return to their indigenous homeland. That is, if Israel gets its way. And Israel will get its way if Arab leaders continue to push the mirage of a two-state solution, a phony promise and aspiration that is meant only to buy Israel more time to annihilate Palestine and expel every Palestinian. Israel knows this, and the United States knows this too. Which is why in the midst of this century's worst genocide, President Biden carried the Zionist state's water when he reiterated this call for a two-state solution during his State of the Union address last month.
Leadership of Israel, I say this, humanitarian assistance cannot be a secondary consideration or a bargaining chip. Protecting and saving innocent lives has to be a priority. As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time.
But U.S. and Israeli politicians have talked about a two-state solution for decades. But the illegal settlements keep growing while Palestinian life and culture continues to shrink.
We, the people of Palestine, hereby offer the Israelis an alternative path to peace. Approach us as equals within a two-state solution.
Let me say to you, the Palestinians, we understand to live together on the same soil, in the same land.
And they want to give peace a real chance, a historic reconciliation between our two peoples.
We wish the Palestinian people peace.
The two-state solution is a two-state delusion because Israeli leaders have publicly vowed there will never be an independent Palestinian state under any circumstances because not only are there nearly 1 million illegal Jewish settlers in the occupied territories, but also because these Palestinian territories possess what Israel lacks: natural resources, specifically oil, gas, and water. Gaza is rich in gas, as we revealed on this program several months ago, whereas the Golan Heights contains an abundance of oil, with the West Bank holding vital water reserves. I mean, the state of Israel is so depraved that it not only steals water from the occupied West Bank, but also sells the same water back to the Palestinians for an obscene profit, while also denying Palestinian farmers access to the main water supply to help Jewish settler farmers maintain the upper hand over their subjugated rivals. And it's also important to recognize that while Israeli forces are committing genocide in Gaza, Jewish settlers and soldiers are mass murdering Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, where Hamas does not operate, proving once again that annihilating Gaza was never about toppling Hamas, but only about reinvigorating and expanding the Greater Israel Project, or what Netanyahu calls the New Middle East, a Middle East in which Arab governments acquiesce to Israel's colonial enterprise.
We will not only bring down barriers between Israel and our neighbors, we'll build a new corridor of peace and prosperity that connects Asia through the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Israel, to Europe.
In calling for peace and security, pro-Palestinian activists must now embrace this undeniable reality about the state of Israel, that Israel's proven through its violence and violations of international law that it will never allow Palestinians to live freely and in peace. We must recognize that for Palestinians, there can never be coexistence with this genocidal fascist state. Zionism must be dismantled. This 76-year-long nightmare must come to an abrupt end. There can only be one state, a Palestinian state that is free from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, and we must not be cowed into retreating from this position. This must be the new demand, because it's exactly what Israel demands, remembering that the ruling party of the Zionist state promises to incorporate all of Palestine into Israel's fold. It should now be obvious that Palestinians and pro-Palestinian supporters fight this battle on equal terms. Because two-state platitudes, vacuous words of condemnation and sanctions are not enough. A realization that has now dawned on my journalist colleagues in the West, who are now calling for a military intervention in the wake of fresh details about the massacres that took place inside Gaza's Al-Shifa hospital, in which hundreds of surgeons, patients and even children were hogtied and handcuffed before being executed in cold blood as the hospital was systematically destroyed. To end this seven-decade nightmare, we must stop deluding ourselves about a two-state solution. Instead, we must turn back the clock to 1947. This was the year when every country in the Middle East and North Africa that had achieved independence from their colonial rulers voted against the 1947 partition of Palestine, because the Palestinian people were not formally considered in a vote, and because it partitioned their homeland to accommodate unlawful Zionist immigration, which they had resisted from the onset. The Palestinian Liberation Organization formalized this opposition, insisting that Palestine, as defined within the boundaries that existed during the British Mandate, was, and I quote, an indivisible territorial unit, and that Palestine be one secular democratic state and not be carved up into two separate entities. By the time we reached the 1980s, however, Yasser Arafat had come to accept that partition was the only viable choice, because by that stage, Palestinians had been worn down and decimated by the machinery of the Zionist occupation. Therefore, he reluctantly accepted partition as a way of achieving separateness from Israeli soldiers and settlers. But three decades later, Palestinians now understand that separateness and peace is never going to come their way. They've seen the United States declare its commitment to Palestinian statehood while simultaneously blocking efforts at the United Nations to end the criminal Israeli occupation of their homeland. It's for this reason that when Palestinians hear the words two-state solution, they only see more bombs, more settlements, more apartheid, and more war. Now, while a single Palestinian state from the river to the sea might appear unrealistic or fantastical or even a recipe for further bloodshed, as noted by this Palestinian scholar, a single Palestinian state is the only state that can exist in the real world. And if you're struggling to comprehend what this future might look like, then I urge you to recall the past, where Muslims, Christians, and Jews coexisted peacefully side by side for centuries in Palestine. That is, of course, until waves of Zionist migrants started arriving from Europe in the 1920s, before forming themselves into Jewish terrorist groups in the 1930s to liquidate 512 Palestinian towns and villages. A decade later, they forcibly expelled 1 million Palestinians during the 1948 Nakba to make way for a Jews-only state. I don't pretend to have all the answers here, but a single Palestinian state is achievable if Arab and African governments start imagining it. Israel claims it's surrounded by a sea of enemies, so it's about time Israel's Arab neighbors act like enemies. And they can act like the Zionist state's enemy by withdrawing from the Abraham Accords, ending calls for a two-state solution and promising joint military action if Israel continues with its plans to forever kill any hope of a viable Palestinian state. And if these Arab regimes don't follow these steps, then they will eventually fall, because the Arab people care deeply for their Palestinian brothers and sisters. They will not stand by idly as their governments allow Palestine to perish. And these regimes should take encouragement from knowing that Israel is not strong. The strength of the Zionist army has always been overblown. Hamas has exposed its weakness today, and Hezbollah exposed this in 2006, when Zionist forces were forced into a humiliating retreat. Today, illegal Zionist settlers are also in retreat, and now getting a taste of their own medicine in promising not to return to their illegal settlements out of concerns for their safety. Arab regimes must and can work together to make Israel Palestine again, because ultimately a two-state solution is no less offensive to Palestinians than it is to Europeans or Americans. So let's work towards one Palestinian state from the river to the sea, with equal rights for all, including Christians and Jews, like it was prior to the birth of the Zionist state in 1948. This is not only the most viable and plausible way forward, but also will bring permanent peace and prosperity to the Middle East. It's high time for Arab governments to act accordingly. And that's my time for today. Please don't forget to subscribe to this channel, and we kindly ask you please support our effort to expose and confront injustices in the Muslim world by becoming a member of this show at patreon.com/CJWilliman. We can't produce, sustain, and grow the show without your help, and we offer exclusive benefits to those who do. But for now, good morning, good evening, wherever you are, and stay blessed.
In January 1968, the Viet Cong launched a surprise attack on South Vietnam and the US Army. It became known as the Tet Offensive. It was supposed to trigger an insurrection in the South, but that never materialized. What did happen was a meltdown in American public opinion. the Pentagon came under unprecedented criticism for its optimistic assessment of the course of the Vietnam War. A credibility gap opened up between the then US President Lyndon B. Johnson and Americans. LBJ himself lost faith in the way his top general was fighting in Vietnam and replaced him. In 1968, Columbia University in New York became the epicenter of the anti-war protest, spurred on by the university's ties to the defense industry. Students occupied five buildings and took its dean, Henry Coleman, hostage for 36 hours. The police were called in. There were hundreds of student arrests, injuries, a strike, and then the resignation of Columbia's president, Grayson Kirk. Anti-war protests reached a climax outside the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, and were later seen as one of the reasons for the election of the Republican, Richard Nixon, as president. Meanwhile, the anti-war protests spread like wildfire to Europe, first to West Berlin and then to Paris, where in May 1968, a worker and student revolt triggered 10 weeks of street battles. At one point, the Élysée lost its nerve and French President Charles de Gaulle scuttled to Germany. The next day, 500,000 workers marched through Paris, chanting Adieu de Gaulle. Does all this sound familiar? There is a major student revolt going on in US campuses right now over Joe Biden's backing of Israel's war in Gaza. Once again, Columbia University is its epicenter. Last night, students occupied Hamilton Hall, and after the university started suspending more students. This building was occupied by protests in 1968. The protesters spread to 30 other universities and colleges. At the conservative Ivy League Yale, students are demanding the university divest from all weapons manufacturing companies contributing to Israel's assault on Palestine. Yale has exchanged students with seven Israeli universities. Harvard has programs with three of these universities, while Columbia has relations with four of them. As in 1968, many of these protests have been met by police violence. Over 900 students have been arrested since the first clashes at Columbia over 2 weeks ago. They've also spread to Britain and to Europe. At Trinity College, Cambridge, the portrait of Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary responsible for a statement recognizing the right of Jews to a homeland in Palestine, was defaced and slashed before being removed by the university. London has just seen its 13th national demonstration since the war began. The protests against the war in Gaza, in their persistence and size, are only matched by the million-plus demonstration against Tony Blair's decision to invade Iraq, which in 2003 was the biggest of its kind. In 1968, the targets were the Pentagon and de Gaulle and his repressive paternalism. Today's targets of the anti-war movement is Israel, the pro-Israel lobby, and its chief armourers, America, Britain, and Germany. Spearheading the revolt against Zionism is a new generation of Jew who is turning up in increasing numbers at these protests. The Gaza war is causing an unprecedented debate among Jewry, with leading intellectuals like the Canadian journalist and activist Naomi Klein arguing that Zionism is, and I quote, a false idol that has taken the idea of the promised land and turned it into a deed of sale for a militaristic ethno-state. These events will not be without their consequences. The first is that for the first time in history, Gaza, both its people and its militias and fighters, are displaying a determination to stand and fight, which the PLO and Yasser Arafat never showed. Palestinians now have a leadership which will not give up its major demand and which commands their respect. The second consequence is that a new generation is coming of age in America, the only country that can stop this conflict by withdrawing its military, political, and economic support for Israel. It is still the only country that Israel listens to and takes seriously. The Jews amongst this generation are horrified by what is being done in their name. Horrified by how their religion has been morphed into an apology for ethnic cleansing. Horrified by how their proud and painful heritage has been reduced into a license to kill. Horrified by the power exerted by Israel over the US Congress, the UK Parliament, and every mainstream party in Europe. Jews are challenging the claim that Zionism owns their narrative. For their pains, they're accused by their own community of being traitors. They're called kapos. This is the word the Jews assigned to the Nazi SS to supervise forced labor were given. They're called self-hating or simply animals. But for me, they are the biggest single source of hope in this bleak landscape.
You know, when you see the activity of Hezbollah, of the Houthis, of what Hamas did on October the 7th, and what Iran then did in response to the attack on their consulate, there's a lot of deliberate provocation, I think, of Israel to try and goad them into an overreaction, which may then ruin their global support and sympathy. I mean, I would argue that that is at least a possibility, isn't it?
Well, first of all, it was the Israelis who started this by bombing the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The Iranians did not start this conflict that recently took place between April 1st and April 19th.
But they were there with people from Hezbollah, weren't they? So they were military leaders using the consulate to plan attacks on Israel with leaders of Hezbollah. I mean, that was why they were targeted.
Look, in international law and according to international norms, states don't attack the embassies of other states. This was considered to be a significant provocation.
Unless they're being used as military bases, which it is believed, certainly Israel argues.
No.
I don't know, but it's certainly been argued by Israel that it was being used, part of this consular area was being used as a genuine military base, in which case it becomes a legitimate target if indeed they are meeting with Hezbollah to plan attacks on Israel, isn't it?
There's no evidence that it was being used as a military base. And the fact is that if the Israelis are going to hit the Iranian embassy, the end result is the Iranians are going to retaliate. And they did retaliate. Now, I want to say a few words about that retaliation. It's very important to understand that the Americans and the Iranians orchestrated the Iranian attack so that it would be a limited attack. It would do very little damage to Israel. And the reason this is the case is that neither the Iranians or the United States wanted this conflict. And it was the Israelis who, by attacking the Iranian embassy in Damascus, dragged the Americans and the Iranians into this conflict. And what we tried to do, working with the Iranians before the attack on April 14th and during the attack on April 14th, was to do everything possible to keep it limited and avoid escalation.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome back to the Big Picture Show. I'm sure you've heard those informative clips that I played for you early on. And just to give you a quick, brief insight as to what was discussed, it's no point in repeating what's there already. However, you have to look at it in the context of what's happening at the moment. And there's a lot that's happening. I mean, we've seen it this week. It started off, obviously, before this, with the campus protests taking place throughout the United States. And that has now reverberated and gone into other parts of the world, into Europe, into some of the Arab countries, although it's still very low-key because of obvious reasons. We know how authoritarian the Arab regimes can be and would want to stifle such protests, because at the end of the day, if it's a dictatorial regime, then their biggest worry is about what happens next to us. I mean, one thing is for Palestine, but what happens to us? And that's their biggest fear. It's a very, one would call it cowardice behavior, indeed. As I said, please excuse me for my voice. It's not the best at the moment. It is cowardice behavior, unfortunately. However, there are certain realities that one must accept. And one of the things that we are seeing is that the Arab citizens in the Middle East are pushing their governments to take forceful action against Israel in any form whatsoever in order to save the Palestinian people. Pushing for ceasefire, even if it doesn't mean them, you know, coming out openly, which is, of course, let's be realistic to each other, it's a very rare sight or a very rare occurrence that will happen. Can you imagine tomorrow a leader like Sisi or MBS or MBZ standing on a at a international press conference and said openly, we condemn the state of Israel for the actions. We demand a ceasefire. That inaction, unfortunately, is what is boiling people to such extreme anger levels that is now obviously fueling into sectarianism. And unfortunately, it's given a rise to a new breed or a new generation of what we can call, and please understand where I'm coming from on context here. I'm not taking a side. It comes into the form of what one would say, a new breed, a new generation of, and in inverted commas, Shia sympathizers or pro-Iran supporters. But that's not necessarily the case, that the people who hold those views are of that mindset. It's because of the inaction by the Arab despots. And it's only natural for people to say, but Iran is speaking out. Hezbollah is firing rockets into Israel all the time. What our Muslim leaders, what our the leaders of the Sunni countries are doing. Again, I'm making it very clear that I don't want to take this into a Shia-Sunni debate, and I won't let that happen. I won't allow it. Because at the end of the day, what we also see is that the moment one is critical over Iran's actions, or Hezbollah, not for that matter, then those who are in support of those views, when you are critical, then you are labeled sectarian. Like how the Zionist will keep quickly, the moment you say something about Israel, about Netanyahu, about Israel's genocide in Gaza, you are labeled anti-Semitic. Right? And then at the same time, those who will tell those people on the opposite side that, oh, you're anti-Sunni. So we don't want all that to come about. One has to look at the matter on hand realistically and approach it from a mature standpoint. Now, not last week, the week before, I spoke about my trip to Al-Aqsa. And I must have mentioned that I was stuck the one night in Amman in Jordan. It happened to be the night of April 13, morning of April 14, when Iran sent those drones over to attack Israel. Now, there was a lot of celebration in Buha about, yes, finally, Iran has stood up for Gaza. Iran did not stand up for Gaza. According to Iran media, and one can go and Google it, and I have the stuff here from Tehran Times, etc., Iran has made it explicitly clear that what they did, if what you call it the April 14th attack, which was known as Operation True Freedom, was in retaliation for Israel's attack on its consulate in Damascus on April 1st, whereby several people died, at least about 13, of which 7 to 8 of them were generals from the Iranian army. Now, you heard Piers Morgan being rattled by John Mersheimer, right? And I said I'm going to talk about who's John Mersheimer to you. Now, the thing is that what I'm trying to tell people is that I was there. If you want to believe me or not, that's another story. But I was there at that moment, that night. And people will commentate and make some silly comments. Oh, Jordan had no business to shut down the airspace. Jordan had no business to shoot down the drones. Saudi Arabia, together with the United States and Jordan, went and shut down the Iran drones. If they left them alone, it could have done more harm to Israel. Hold on. Let's be realistic. And let's be truly honest to ourselves on this approach. And I say this, strongly and objectively that unfortunately for Jordan, there had to be in what we call the crosshairs of this matter, whereby Iran is onto the east of its border behind Iraq, and that those drones had to go over Iraq, which is not a problem because Iraq is on very friendly terms with Iran, but it had to cross Jordanian airspace to get to Israel. Now, by the admission of pro-Iran commentators like George Galloway, Richard Medhurst, Professor Maranda, going by them, and they have said it in the interviews and in the shows that Iran deliberately sent amateurish weapons to make a strong statement to Israel. And that if next time if this carries on, they're going to, then of course the stronger weapons or the more sophisticated weapons will be used. Now, amateurish weapons, technology wise, are more easier to manipulate than sophisticated weapons. Again, I'm giving you this approach from an objective standpoint. Now, those drones were coming in one direction from the east to the west and had to cross Jordanian airspace. Again, no defense of Jordan. Right? And I wouldn't have understood the situation had I not been there that night. That Jordan had to shut down the airspace for one simple reason. Forget whether they're siding with Israel or that, I'm saying for one simple reason is that those drones, they could not afford the risk of those drones colliding with civilian aircraft. Right? Around 10 o'clock that night on April 13, which was 9 o'clock here in South African time, I got word from South Africa that Jordanian airspace was shut down. We couldn't get word that night. We didn't know what was going on because, for some reason, the mobile networks were erratic. I was at a friend's house. The Wi-Fi was not working properly. Okay, and then he further found out that the GPS networks were interfered with, what SatNav was interfered with. So nobody really knew what was going on. Call comes from South Africa to say, are you guys okay? We just heard Jordan has announced they shut down the airspace. I said, we don't know anything. Informed my host. My host made a few calls to somebody who phoned the manager of the airport and said, yes, that is true. The government has ordered the airspace to be shut down. We're closing the airport. Everybody must go home. This was 10 o'clock at night in Jordan time. My flight was supposed to leave at 3 in the morning, of which the hype of activities took place over Jordanian airspace. Now, had my plane taken off at 3 in the morning and one of those drones collided, what would have been the result? I want to ask that very frank question to all those people who are making their own assumptions and theories out there. So it was natural for the Jordanian government to shut down the airspace. Whether the Jordanian government now has allowed Israel or given them permission to come and use their airspace to tackle the Iranian drones, that's all speculation and hearsay. We can speculate and go on till doomsday about it. But what is an established fact is that the Jordanian Air Force responded by taking down those drones that were going through its airspace, especially those that were flying over populated civilian neighborhoods. Now, to give you an example, that night I had to go and check in at the hotel again because obviously the airport was closed and we were uncertain how many days we're going to be held back for. So we found a hotel and we checked in for the night to stay. And then between 3 to 5 in the morning, you're hearing, although I was much more in a deeper sleep, but according to what my wife said, other friends that were with us saying, they could hear lots of explosion and loud noises. It was, of course, the Jordanian Air Force shooting down those drones. Again, whether they did the right thing or wrong thing can be debatable. But what has been one fact that has been established, and I think there was a clip by Middle East Eye that went around showing the one drone shot down over a suburb of Amman. And I saw it the next day, and I showed it to somebody I knew. And in his own words to me, he says, "Brother, this neighborhood is over 6 kilometers away from this hotel." So I asked him, "What you mean?" He says, "Yes, where that drone got shot down was not far from here. Now, if that drone was left alone, it could have crashed somewhere into somebody's house, into an apartment building, or anywhere for that matter. What would have been the consequence? It would have been a risk to civilian lives." Now, coming back to the point here, you heard the clip whereby John Mersheimer rattled Piers Morgan in setting the record straight. And he said, Piers Morgan made a whole lot of silly, stupid, ludicrous allegations that Iran was using its consulate in Damascus as a command base. And he says, well, at least Israel has been saying that. And John Mersheimer said that there's no proof in it. And the fact is, there's no proof. It's speculation. But then he also went on to say, and I told people that this particular drone attack off April 14 was done in coordination with the U.S. government. Because at the end of the day, Iran said, "We've taken too many hits over the years from Israel in Syria. We never responded. But this is where we draw the line. Attacking our consulate, attacking, which is obviously goes by against the Geneva Convention and all international law, is where we draw the line, and we are going to respond. And we will respond." And there was ongoing communication saying we are going to respond. Of course, the U.S. responded to the Iranians and said that you have to, you know, keep it minimum. And you heard John Mersheimer telling Piers Morgan that it was done in coordination with them to keep it minimum so that the matter or the situation does not escalate further. In other words, it does not result in a regional bloodbath. I'm talking now in the context of the matter. And that is a fact. Because a week later, maybe 5 days later, the Friday night after April 14, or the Friday morning, was it that Iran responded and, Israel responded and shot some missiles into Western Iran. And then it all stopped. Unfortunately, everything has stopped between then and now. Or should we say sanity has prevailed in that situation? Because the consequence of what happened is that it boosted Netanyahu's so-called credibility and his rotten credibility, because Netanyahu is under a lot of fire from his allies. And although we say that, oh, we must not believe it, in fact, we don't really believe it. Because at the end of the day, America will say, "Israel, you're wrong. Netanyahu, behave yourself." The next day, they're sending billions of dollars over. However, the global tide of public opinion has turned against Israel, against Netanyahu. And Netanyahu found the perfect opportunity to bait Iran. And more so knowing that in the past, Israel has done many skirmishes into Syrian airspace, hitting at Iranian assets. For example, whether it's an arms dump or arms depot, etc. I'm just giving you an example, right? However, pushing the envelope far and attacking an embassy or a consulate for that matter, he knew that this time they're going to retaliate. And they did retaliate. And immediately when that night happened of the drone attacks, already the attention was taken away from Gaza. But fortunately, it came out publicly that whatever Iran did that night, they did not just do it unilaterally. They kept the United States informed. And the United States was aware. And the United States came back to them and said, "Keep it minimal. Do not let it go to a point where the situation can escalate." So they were dragged into it and they were complicit in it. So immediately, that attention taken away from Gaza lasted a week at the time. unfortunately, it's now once again back into the central spotlight. That, my dear friends, is the dirty scenario of how politics can outplay in a situation like this. The Jordanian people are very angry at their king or at their government, although they love their king, but at their government for the manner in which they responded to those drone attacks. Right? They said that they should have just let the drones go over the airspace into Israel. But then when they saw that there was a risk of those drones falling into civilian neighborhoods of Jordan, then they realized, okay, wait a minute, our government did the right thing. And how so? Because those drones went on a journey of 9 hours across. And in 9 hours, Israel had ample time and opportunity to manipulate those drones. I mentioned earlier about the network, mobile network being erratic, the Wi-Fi being erratic. It was established that the GPS network was interfered with and the SatNav. That night, while I was with this friend of mine's, showing me we are here in Amman, correct? I said, yes, look at my phone, what the GPS is showing. It's showing we're at Beirut Airport, which is several hours away. So those GPS settings of the drones were tampered with, and Israel deliberately did that. And we all know that Israel possesses the technology and the sophistication to manipulate such things. And yes, the United States helped them, because again, what the United States had to save face, although they said, okay, indirectly telling Iran, go ahead and do what you want to, but keep it minimal. But at the end of the day, the United States' main darling is Israel, and a priority is Israel, or should we say the United States establishment. And those drones, GPS was manipulated and sent off course to fall down anywhere. And we all know what happened the next day. The result was that it hit one army base there on the eastern border of occupied Palestine, and apparently a Bedouin girl was injured from one of those other ones that fell in the neighborhood there, but there were no serious casualties. It was a statement made and a warning. So again, approaching the matter realistically. Again, when I come to other parts, that whether what Saudi Arabia was part of it to shoot down this and that, we're not going to go into all those details yet. Already it's emerged from Russia today, on the day after the following day, the Monday, the 15th of April, Russia Today, which is RT News, said that they found that Israeli media were putting out false information that Saudi Arabia joined Israel in defending Israeli airspace against those drones. RT News is saying it, not Western mainstream media, RT News, which is, of course, pro-Iran. But at the same time, you must know that Russia is also courting Saudi Arabia and China as well, because Russia and China are bringing Iran and Saudi Arabia together to BRICS. In fact, they should officially, they're supposed to have joined at the beginning of the year, but waiting for certain formalities, etc., so to take place till they officially are declared BRICS members. Already we've seen Argentina back out. But then again, that's a discussion for another time. So, dear listeners, this is what's the reality of the situation, and that's why John Mosheiber rattled Piers Morgan and said, wait a minute, what you're saying is nonsense. There's no evidence that of the embassy or the consulate used as a command center, that this was a coordinated attack, and what Israel did, Israel provoked the situation, dragged in the United States to basically let happen what happened that night. And for those who don't know, as I said, John Mosheiber is an American political scientist and international relations scholar, right? He belongs to what we call the realist school of thought. He's written several books, right? The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy back in 2007. Another one called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics in 2001. And another popular book called The Great Delusion in 2018. His latest book that came out last year in 2023, How States Think, the rationality of foreign policy. And there was another popular one in 2010 known as Why Leaders Lie. Of course, we can see it with Joe Biden, with Netanyahu especially, and several others, Rishi Sunak, etc., how they can lie. And they will lie, especially in a situation of this sort, to protect their protege, their beloved, what we call the Great Israelite. So these five books were written by, and one can Google it under John Mersheimer, were written by him in the past 24 years. The other clips talking about the Arab nations, as I said, the people are pushing their governments. And the one by David Hurst, the editor of Middle East Eye, about what he said about Vietnam, and he's making reference to what happened back then during the Vietnam War, and he's now relating it in comparison to what is currently happening at universities in America, and now obviously that spread to Europe, that this is the moment. The university movement is the movement that can make a difference. And you are seeing already that the Americans are not taking this lightly. In fact, what the response by the American authorities against all those that are having sit-ins at the various campuses has been extremely heavy-handed. And you can see that AIPAC, the most dangerous lobbying group in the world, American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, is driving this. They are pushing the U.S. authorities to do their dirty work. At the end of the day, their hands appear to be clean, and the American government will be the bad one for what they've done. God forbid that they open fire on these protesters and lives will be lost. Some people say, let it happen. I think that's a very nasty thing to say, because at the end of the day, these people are there genuinely out there to make a statement. Why say let it happen? Let them make the difference. Let them be successful in what they do. Dear listeners, that's all I have time for this first segment of the Big Picture Show today. Until next week, inshallah, for those listeners on Radio Al Ansar, I have two clips to play after the 12 o'clock news. As I said, please bear with me as my voice is not 100%. Until next week, inshallah, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.